Okay, let's get started. Today is lecture 16 on requirements. It's the first of two lectures on requirements and use cases, which are very closely related. 16 means that we are now one lecture past the halfway point of this course, which is either a really amazingly good thing, or I'm like, oh my God, we're half done already, and we haven't got anything done yet, or something like that. So it's one way or the other, you can look at it. Today I'm going to talk about what requirements are, and to try to help you see requirements as this bridge between the things you've done up to now in this course, in terms of your projects, in terms of generating ideas from a number of different sources, and then refining those ideas in a way that's precise enough and prioritized enough to know exactly what to do about them, which ones you should actually act on as you design your service systems. We'll talk a lot about methods for identifying and specifying and communicating requirements, in particular with techniques for using, say, simplified or more precise language to eliminate the ambiguity in requirements, so you can actually communicate what you think you mean to people who need to evaluate your requirements. I spent a little bit of time on, as I've done many times this semester, talking about the one particular end of this continuum we've talked about many times between experience and information intensivity, to talk about some generic requirements that tend to be always manifested in information-intensive contexts. And you'll see that there are a dozen things that you might be wanting to do, and there's always trade-offs among these things. And that's part of what's interesting when you go do analysis of organizations. They often have incompatible or conflicting views about which of these requirements are the most important. And I'll maybe tell a story about that if I remember not to mention the name of the company this time, I'll tell the story. And finally, I'll talk a bit about business rules, which is kind of an emerging buzzword you may have seen in the design of information systems as a way of having a more formal or refined statement of requirements. Often they said they can be expressed in a way that it can be interpreted by a decision engine or a decision service that enforces these requirements in a way which is independent of the particular application code of some particular front-end application. So requirements are essentially constraints on possible solutions or goals that have to be satisfied for some solution to be acceptable to the stakeholders. But of course that means that, you know, how you define the stakeholders that will have the point of view of some stakeholders will change what your requirements are and their priority. As I said, requirements are a phase of a design project that are really the bridge between these fairly open-ended, inspirational or ideational, whatever your word is, that says we generate possibilities and then we have to decide which ones we're actually going to act on. So it's this bridge between sort of this open-ended space and the more closed-end half the project when you start worrying about specification and implementation. Most of the time, requirements are functional. That is, our system or application or service needs to do this. That's a functional requirement. But often we have performance requirements, or we have what are often called the quality attributes or the illities. Things like usability, reliability, portability, interoperability. These are often harder to quantify, and that's one of the issues we'll talk about today. It's easy to say this thing must be able to lift 100 pounds versus it must be easy to use. And that's why it's important to be able to stress making requirements as verifiable and as objective as possible. Often a requirement will be the need to conform to standards or laws or regulations or other kinds of, perhaps arbitrary kind of constraints that might be tied to the geographical or geopolitical context in which you're trying to implement the solution. Because, of course, we could have different rules in different countries or different cities and things like that that really, in some sense, are arbitrary with respect to your project. And the most important thing is that requirements do not say how the solution is to be achieved. That's a designer. So the requirements should be expressed in ways which do not assume the solution implementation. So they're really technology neutral. That's why they're actually important to write. They don't tie the hands of the designers, because often requirements are done by different people, different organizations, even different companies than the people who are charged with actually designing and building the thing. As I've said many times this semester, defining the scope, identifying the stakeholders, and the priorities of the stakeholders are iterative activities that have a great influence on your projects. You can't really write requirements and set priorities until you've decided what the point of view and the stakeholders are that are most important. Because they essentially say, what is in or out of scope? What is inside or outside the boundary in which our thing has to work? And where that falls depends on which stakeholder perspectives you emphasize. Again, I mentioned before that you often default to this idea that the user or the end user or the customer is this point of view. That's often arbitrary. You often can take many different points of view, and many of you have taken points of view which are different than the one you might have otherwise taken by default. A good example is the We Make It Safer product recall people who have consciously decided to take the perspective of the vendors of product rather than the users of product, which is exactly the opposite way you might think about that problem. That's why it's a nice complementary solution to some existing work that they've done. But a really important thing and a very tricky thing to get at is really what I call dependency and scope. And this is much easier to talk about to death than to really explain. Because, as I say here, there's often very difficult to say what the dividing line between the documents, the processes, and the services that you care about and the ones you don't care about. Because they're not often easily separable. Now, once in a blue moon, you'll be lucky and you have some situation like where there is a clear boundary. So, for example, if I go into a medical office and I say, I want to improve the process by which we make appointments for people. Right now, they call up and we look in our physical book and we write something down and we tell them what time we gave them. Let's improve that in a way, maybe by automating in some way, using maybe a web form that goes into a schedule book or something like that. That's a fairly bounded service where it doesn't connect with everything else that the hospital office does. On the other hand, suppose we said, let's change the medical plans that the people can sign up for. That will have profound changes on which doctors you can see, how billing gets done, how reimbursements gets done, which drugs you can be prescribed, which hospitals you can go to, who you can see, all kinds of other things. Because that change crosses a lot of boundaries. And so most of the time you'll have that boundary crossing problem. And your challenge will be to say, well, how many of those kind of dependencies that cross boundaries are really important ones? Can we kind of simplify and ignore some of them, or do we have to really worry about them? And then again, that's hard to explain in check this kind of language, but you're going to find places where your things bleed into other things and you have to decide, no, we're not going to go there. Those requirements are not going to be important to understand. Again, this is related to the thing I mentioned many times this semester about what's the front stage and what's the backstage. Now, you have this line of visibility. How many things do you want people to be able to see or interact with? And of course, as I showed in the front stage and backstage inversion in the cooking school and the restaurant, the whole thing could overturn in a moment if you had to take a different point of view. And so you really have to be focused and say, we're doing this, and this is where the boundaries are. And that's part of what you are probably undergoing now in your project as you find different kinds of possibilities. Where are you going to draw that line? Because the line is not going to be sharp. It's not going to be a nice, fine, black line where you say, this is our project and everything else we don't care about. Because you're going to say, oh, well, what about this? Well, we decided that that's outside of scope. All right, well, where do requirements come from? Well, again, as I've said this before, the first few things we've done this semester in assignments have been to generate possible ideas, and we've used a number of different techniques. We've used review of the technical literature, review of technology, competitive analysis of similar or analogous kinds of solutions from our own experience. You're about to go do some ethnographic activity where you observe or you analyze information flows, again, to get some inspiration or possible requirements. You can often do a more precise job of that, a more should we say, reliable job of that. If you go into an interview or an observation with some kind of plan or a meta model for collecting that information, that's one reason why I asked you in the assignment to create an engagement plan, where you say, which things are we going to try to observe and collect? That might mean you have a standard questionnaire or a standard interview form so everyone gets asked the same questions. One thing I've often done is to give people some sense of what questions you want to ask them in advance, so that when you go to talk to them, they'll be somewhat more prepared and give you essentially deeper, more nuanced answers than to just say, well, I want to come and ask you some questions. So if you have planned interviews, you may be able to send people a message saying, look, here's what I want to talk about, these kinds of things. Maybe that'll help you prepare. One thing that you need to be aware of is that depending on how much they trust you, they'll tell you more or less. And many times there are things people are dying to tell you, but they don't know if they can trust you with the information. And that's why if you're doing anything other than a rapid ethnographic activity, you'd want to make multiple visits to the same organization or the same setting so you could ask questions over and over again. In some sense, both to get triangulations, confirmations of the things they tell you, but also to give them a chance to say, you know, something I've been meaning to tell you, but... And that happens a lot when they finally get to trust you. We had a fascinating interview of sorts last night. We had a dinner, Aaron and Nate and I went out to dinner with a person who is heavily involved in the development of learning systems, which is related to the project that they're interested in. And halfway through the conversation, he said, I need to tell you something really interesting. And he starts laying out this incredible political backstory that I think will save them a lot of grief in a future interview. It was just, wow. And it's because we had a little bit of wine and we were sort of talking about stuff. And they just came and just opened up in a way that I could never have anticipated when we started that meeting. So who can help you with requirements? This is actually a really important thing that I would call an MBA moment, because something that I learned the hard way, and that is that you can get requirements from a lot of different people, but you should never assume that they know each other, they talk to each other, that they even agree with each other. So everybody can give you a different story, and they believe that story is true. So we have users, of course, users of whatever, either the existing systems or method of operations or services, who you might want to ask questions of. And there may be different classes of users, and sort of how you put people into the classes will affect how you treat them. There may be many different kinds of categorization schemes of users. One thing that I think Uyghurs hinted at was that there may be favored classes of users and not so favored classes of users, and that may be political decisions. Which people are you supposed to trust and not trust? You often have the problem that the technical people in an organization, they can speak as user surrogates because they built things that the users use, so they obviously know how to use them. Not necessarily true. Managers often, they can talk for the people who work for them. Not necessarily true. I remember an interview where I wanted to ask because I'd had some hints about, I think I mentioned some of the things about the automotive repair shop, how people were doing things which were not quite kosher and all that. I just wanted to ask the manager, what tasks are too hard for your people to do correctly? What tasks are there that they often have workarounds because the standard processes are either too safe, too kludgy or too time-consuming? Are there things that they do that are unsafe? I mean, they're not going to tell you these things, right? So you have to find ways to get that information through observation or through, again, triangulation by looking at other evidence, like maybe there's broken equipment that happened because someone tried to do a workaround or something like that. Of course, you can talk to customers, and the standard slogan is that the customer is always right, but that's completely wrong. I think a better way to think about it is what Bigger says, is that the customer is not always right, but the customer always has a point. And maybe they don't have good expectations of what's supposed to happen, so they have a delusion about what should happen, but that delusion is part of what you need to understand, why they have that expectation. Again, you talked a few weeks ago about the gap model of service quality. There are a lot of places where they could get those wrong expectations, and some of them are going to be your fault if you're the designer of the service system. There are some interesting categories of subject matter experts. And again, I learned this the hard way. a consultant in an organization is often brought in by the client or the customer organization to help them decide what they need or how they should attack some problem. And you may interact with that client, that consultant, when you go in that into that organization. They may be there on site when you're going in to do your part of the project. They may have conflicts of interest. So someone hired as a consultant to work for some customer, some organization, to help them figure out what to do, and then you're hired to do something that helps that, they're likely to tell you what? What are they going to recommend to you? What's the most likely thing they're going to recommend to you about the solution or the approach taken? That they should be part of it. What they're selling should be part of that solution. So everybody has a point of view. They say, I represent some technology vendor or some particular methodology. This should be an important part of our solution. Well, because they may have a conflict of interest. The other problem is what we call the gatekeeper. Gatekeepers are particularly dangerous persons to stay away from. And it's very difficult to do for people like you. And like I used to be before I did some bad things with gatekeepers. All right. The problem is this. You go into an organization and you want to understand, and it's a technology-intensive organization. So they have you talk to somebody who's like the chief technical person or the chief architect or the chief something or other in that organization. And because you're a smart person, do you think you like them? You say, look, this is great. We talk to this guy. We have a great chat with this guy. And we talk about stuff. Okay, what's his role in meeting you? Why has he been asked to meet you? Why has his management said, you should talk to Bob or the consultant coming in we brought in? What's his role? To help you out?
To only share certain information with you to hold back your
important information. He's there primarily to say, is this person worth talking to? Is he smart enough to help us? So they get the smartest person they got to talk to the consultant to see if that person can add any value to their organization. So his job is primarily to keep you out. All right? Now, if you are really impressive, then you guys will go out and have a beer afterwards and have a great time, and you forget why you were there. Because you get so infatuated with someone who's as smart as you, that you kind of lose sight of the fact you're supposed to be there to get into the organization, not to have a good time with the gatekeeper. So it's really important I know some of you would have a natural disposition to go and find the gatekeeper and just spend great time with him. Because you're smart, technically interesting people, lots of interesting things going on. It's a black hole. Then when the manager goes, well, what have you learned today? And you go, oh man, you this. And he says, I know he's smart. That's why I don't talk to you. What did you learn from our organization? Well, I didn't actually talk to anybody else. Bad, bad thing. You get fired that day. Happened to me twice. So I figured out what the pattern was. Okay. Again, gatekeepers are almost always able to say no and very rarely able to say yes. Their job is to tell their boss, who is the person with the checkbook typically, or runs the organization, should this person consult and be allowed to continue this project? I'm sure that Stephanie has had these kind of people to interact with. When you go into a company, they go, well, talk to so-and-so first. They'll give you some lay of the land. What they're doing is saying, can this person possibly help us before we waste everyone else's time talking to them? Right? How do you do those people? You wow them.
Yeah.
All right. Okay. I was told by the person who taught me to be a consultant that the most important thing to do is to find the checkbook. Your first task when you go into an organization is to find the checkbook. Because that person will ultimately decide how much access you get, whether this project will continue or not. We tend to call that the executive project sponsor because it's a little bit better than saying find the checkbook, but you find the checkbook. Who basically is going to have to write the bills to you to pay for your time to be the consultant to figure out what's going on in their organization?
What if you're approaching somebody and you're volunteering your time for a project for school? I mean, does your approach can be a little bit different then? They don't have to pay you, really.
Well, but it depends whether they think their time is valuable or not. You're saying, I want to come and spend a couple days, weeks, months with your company and talk to people, and they go, we got work to do. What value could you possibly add to us? So they have the gatekeeper talk to him and say, can this guy cough? Does he have any sense? Does he help us or not? Otherwise, tell him to go do something in the library. All right? I mean, seriously. Their time is valuable. And don't you know, think that because you're volunteering that they want to have you in the organization. And finally, I think this is the point made very clearly in the OISD book about stakeholders, was that the internal stakeholders can be very, very helpful. People like your marketing and salespeople, if you're an organization that we're trying to understand the customers, they have a lot of ongoing contact with people. And they may be better social skills, which is why they're in those roles, and they may be better actually getting information from people than you might be or other people might be. They certainly know more about what the people who actually do things do than the gatekeeper does. Okay. Another bit of a trick about finding people who can help you is that you want to find responsibility-based... Okay, I guess you want to distinguish between responsibility-based classification of people and task-based classification of people. By that I mean, you can go into an organization and say, oh, he's the systems programmer, he's the machine operator, they're the admissions clerk, they're the night watchman, they're the whatever. They have job titles, okay? And that often gets you in the trap of saying, oh, okay, so the night watchman watches things at night. Okay, the system operator operates the system. Because that's what their job says they do, okay? But they may do lots of other things, which if you focus on what they call themselves and where they fit in the org chart, you'll never bother to observe or ask them about. So what you really want to know is, what exactly do you do around here, as opposed to what do they say your job is around here? Because often, again, if they're supposed to do things which are not supposed to, but are essential to the company's success. They're doing something which they know is important because they've been around a while and it's critical to the company's success, but it's not in the job description. They got to sort of say, well, you know, I've been doing this because otherwise things would fall through the cracks. I mean, I know what the, you know, staple is up to the order paper was about. You know, I know that I have to do this or otherwise things never get out of my office to the next guys, but it's not my job. So I kind of just do it to make it happen because I don't want us to go out of business or whatever it is, right? But that kind of stuff is important to get because it's a crack, but it's not going to ever come out of a formal job description. So if you fix it on that, you won't find it. Okay? So you want to think in terms of what people are kind of making happen rather than what they're supposed to be doing on their job description. And that makes it easier to see what they're doing might not be being done in the most effective way. Maybe there's an opportunity to improve the productivity or the efficiency or the effectiveness of the customer value in the organization by doing things differently. So if you say, what is the job of the shipping clerk? It's not to fill out the forms, it's to get stuff from point A to point B. And so if they spend all day long filling out forms, you know, you should say, well, does filling out forms help you get things from point A to point B? Well, no, it's the audit afterwards. Well, then it's a waste of time, for example. So, you know, find out what they're supposed to be doing and ensure that what they're doing is consistent with their goals, not with their current job description, especially since that job description may never change. What is the responsibility of the people, say, that the mechanics on a factory floor? Okay? Is it to follow the maintenance guide? No, it's to keep the machines running. Now, it's get a clearer view of what their real responsibility, what their real objective is, and not be distracted by other stuff. Maybe that you need to redesign the manuals or other information to make it possible for them to do their job better, but their job is not to follow the manual. The job is to keep the machine running. So again, make sure you separate sort of causality issues, goal stuff, from what they're currently dealing with as part of the situation that they're in. And one way to do that is to think more abstractly about their goals. This is why I've been big on things like design patterns. I've talked about design patterns several times. I talked about it yesterday, on Monday, when I talked about the build-to-order Berkeley problem, when I said, let's imagine that trying to register for classes and get through Berkeley as a student is a supply chain problem. Okay? And how does that more abstract way of looking at what it means to select courses and try to assemble, you know, some coherent body of courses that will meet some educational objective for you so you can get a degree, how is that like or unlike a successful supply chain or a successful, say, build-to-order process for someone like Dell Computer? And having this design pattern will highlight certain requirements or constraints in a way that, that having a more literal bottom-up view of things might not show you. So, again, the idea is that selecting a pattern to say, I'm going to try to see if I can apply this pattern to this situation may give you insight. So, you know, saying, how is Berkeley like a supply chain makes you ignore like departmental politics and says, the problem is there's no commitment that's made that's binding between supplier A and buyer B. And what's causing that, well, that's important to deal with, but the primary problem is the lack of a commitment. That's what you can focus on. So choosing a pattern, in a sense, will tell you what things to look for, which things are likely to be problematic. Here's an example. I've talked a bit about, either in this class or other classes, about the event calendar network that some of my students built and then finished up as a campus project in IT to build the Berkeley event calendar network, where there is essentially one master calendar, one master repository of events run by public affairs, and individual departments and units can submit events to that master calendar and then create calendars by having views or subscriptions from that master calendar based on the particular metadata about the nature of the event or originator, things like that. And when we started this project, we were saying, well, we had this problem. We have 80 different calendars with different models, and so as a result, there's a lot of wasted effort of re-entering events in different calendars and so on. How should we think about this problem? And we realized that there were two distinct design patterns we could apply to this situation. One was to say, it's a syndication problem. That is that there's no easy way for people to go to this master calendar, if there were such a thing, or go to a calendar in general and subscribe to events. You can't go and get events on demand, be pushed to you. So that's why your calendar is no good, because it doesn't have events that can be pushed to you from everybody else's calendars. That makes you look at certain classes of actors and certain types of problems that you might be able to have to fix. Or you could say, the problem is that there's no reason to try to share stuff if there's not enough stuff to share. So the problem is that there's not enough, it's not easy enough to create a pool of shared events that justifies the work that's through syndication. So it's a supply-side problem, not a demand-side problem. They emphasize very different things. We ultimately decided that it was a supply-side problem and that we needed to find ways to define an event model that would be usable by all these different people who create a calendar. They'd have some basis for wanting to submit events in, because they'd know they'd be able to get them back if they had some kind of a common model. So we emphasized the creation side of that solution, and the demand side took care of itself. Another way to think about that is that there could be a kind of abstract pattern, and you need to look at a number of different ways that might be contextualized, and then see that the intersection of those contextualizations is the thing you're really trying to build. Then we do that in English with a picture. Okay? So, what does it mean for a seller to sell something to a buyer? Well, the buyer, the procurement pattern, the basic purchasing pattern. The buyer places an order, the seller ships the goods, bills the recipient, and the recipient pays the bill. That's the simplest possible purchasing pattern. Well, suppose that the buyer and seller are in different countries. That requires some customizations or extensions of this basic pattern, where now we have things like custom brokers, and we have maybe carriers who are going to help deliver the goods because there's some kind of transportation kind of complexity and so on. You may not be able to read this picture for some reason. I see this, that it's not a very crisp picture. You basically have added customs and brokers and carriers to this picture. Now, so there's more steps now, because we've had to add kind of contextualizations to this simple purchasing pattern. Suppose the goods that are trying to be shipped from point A to point B are hazardous or dangerous. We'll have concerns about hazardous materials handling. Suppose they are export controls, so they have to go through governmental review before you can ship that high technology to the Chinese. Those are going to essentially be clusters of requirements around some core abstract minimal set of requirements. Now, the way I want to depict this is that there's kind of these patterns or clusters of requirements, and the context sort of adds additional part of that. So here I see that there's this kind of common set of requirements in the middle here, and what I see is different kinds of context in which different requirements are more salient. And I want to sort of think, what is this thing in the middle, which is what I really want to build, and then make it possible to customize it for different situations. So if I build one of these specialized things, it may not be very adaptable or flexible to meet all the other ones. But if I build the abstract, simple one in the middle, and then say, make it possible to configure it to meet the other needs, I have a much better solution. So you want to look at sort of, try to find that abstract pattern in the middle of your requirements, and then find ways to tack on the specialty things, you know, in a way which is clean and modular. So again, you can think of this in terms of like component business services. Instead of having one big blob of business functionality, have smaller pieces so they can have this kind of reassembly in different business models. Is this too abstract? This is how I think about this stuff. I mean, you want to build, instead of building, you know, one big blob that meets some particular requirement, that situation that you're in, you look at a number of overlapping kind of related situations, so you find that there's a common to all of them. You want to build that first. And then you try to build on add-on services which enable you to meet all the different configurations. Michael, you have a... Right. Again, I'm trying to talk about requirements, not necessarily the way you do it in your project this semester. But if you have an ambitious project, it's really important to have this broader view that says, I don't want to build the same thing kind of over and over again, tweak it a little bit each time. I'd rather be able to build a generic solution that I can then tailor in an efficient way by adding essentially additional component services, where I plug in extra services into my platform. This is the platform. Think of it that way. All right, this is the platform. These are the plugins to enable you to have a more flexible, adaptable solution, which is, meets a wider range of requirements, but doesn't have, without any redundancy. Yes. Yeah, that's not why I would have... I mean, yeah, this is what I got to in my thinking about design by having confronted too many times about how to do chicken wire to connect stovepipes because they were built as separate solutions. So we built this, and then we built this, and we built this, and we go, gee, they have some overlap. Let's chicken wire them together. Instead of saying, let's look at all three of them together and say, aha, what do they really need to have in common? Let's build this thing and then have ways for them to sort of look like the other ones in different situations. That's a good way to think about it. And that's, I guess I got there by having dealt with too much messy stuff in my life. And I'd forgotten that was my motivation. But yeah, that's because you're saying, I'm tired of doing the same thing over and over and over again. How do I prevent that? I've got to have a more generic solution that I can then customize in a way which meets the requirements, but doesn't require all the work to be done over and over again. So, again, this is a notion of like platform, right? You have a platform that you then build on. The platform is like the 80% solution. It does much of what you want it to do, and then you add on. So this is like, can you give us an example, Stephanie? I mean, it doesn't help to say that a context is a contextualized pattern. I realize that's kind of not entirely helpful, right? But, you know, there's this abstract pattern in the middle, which is that kind of platform solution, the 80% solution. And I'm saying, let's tack on as separate things So I should probably redraw this picture as well and say, instead of this, these then become, I then build, and you know, this piece and this piece and this piece, so I can then create those pieces by assembling the components. Yeah, as you try to take your services and package them into ways which can meet a variety of situations, this way of thinking should be helpful. All right. Have any of you ever worked in really big companies where you've had design projects? Oh yeah, of course you have. Okay. So in really big design projects, we have very big and document-intensive requirements process. In fact, it is so rigorous that there may in fact be processes for how you start the project of collecting requirements. So often if you are the government or the military or Boeing or Ford or some gigantic construction firm, you'll say, we need to have a contract definition phase in which we have requests for information sent out to a number of possible people who might be able to help us satisfy our requirement or even determine the requirements. And they'll then help us come up with some preliminary ideas about how to attack this problem. And that's usually a situation where there's such a complex situation, lots of legacy things, lots of constraints to deal with, that this first step where you say, help us figure out what the problem is going to be, so we can then ask people if they can solve it. So these consultants or these early companies that are involved in the specification of the requirements gathering phase will then help write the RFQ, which is the request for a quote. Now that we have some sense of what we want to build, how would you go about satisfying this problem? How would you carve it up? And how would you sort of come up with some architecture that would be able to satisfy the requirement? So there's this multiple phase, all very transaction intensive. And I've seen RFQs that are 5,000 pages long, saying, here's our requirements. Please bid on this, or bid on some part of this. Put together a team that can bid on this, and it's just—it's an enormous undertaking, and it's can be good or bad. It can be good. You don't want to have people building an air traffic control system by saying, "Let's just build something and see if it works," okay? Or build a space shuttle and see if it works. On the other hand, if you have too precise requirements, you can often stifle innovation because the requirements may be reflecting some particular point of view or biases in some ways that preclude certain kinds of interesting solutions. So there's a kind of trade-off here, and this is something which is you see often in the contrast between, say, the American way of manufacturing and the Japanese way of manufacturing. So in U.S. automotive industry for years, they would have very specific requirements they give to their subcontractors. They build this thing, exactly this. And that would have a very tight contract governing it, and there'd be lots of grinding on the edges about minimizing cost and overruns, that kind of stuff. In contrast, the Japanese or the Toyota way of doing manufacturing in that supply chain would be to say, look, we have this, you have current pieces of equipment in the car that is this big that does this. It'd be great if you could make it a little bit smaller and 50% more effective. A carburetor, make it 50% faster or whatever it is, but make it smaller. Very kind of open-ended requirements, the idea being that it's going to be a collaborative design effort. And some people hate that kind of way of doing business because there's too much ambiguity. Would you rather have a very clear spec, just do this, or to say, solve this problem and there's some very vague constraints? So I've done business in Japan, and it is really weird sometimes because a typical Japanese project, like an engineering project, will be, okay, here's what we want to do with very high-level terms. Let's sign the contract and now go out drinking with the Japanese engineers for 6 months to figure out what it really should be. Where, in some sense, you sign the contract without knowing what you're really going to do, but they trust that the engineers will work together and then sort of figure it out. But this can be very difficult cross-culturally, to put it mildly. And I wasn't very happy because I drink a lot, but I don't drink as much as Japanese engineers do. They have lots of practice, like every night for their entire life. Okay. More typically, there's some middle ground where there is some amount of, and those of you who worked in, say, software companies may have some comfort with this level of description, where you'll have product management, some function which is trying to product marketing. They said that we want to build some set of solutions maybe over time, and here's what the class of functionality of these things should have in them. That's often called the PRD, product requirements document. Some of you have done these. Anybody? Wow. In previous years, half the class would say, I worked in a software company. So you guys are really different. Something's happened to you. Maybe all the outsourcing's happened. That's what's happened. All the engineers are now in India. That's what's happened in 3 to 4 years. Okay, so now the Indian software engineers are doing this, and they're basically negotiating what engineering can do with respect to product management. So the product management organization will be at the home office, and they'll negotiate with the engineering teams wherever they are about what should get done in any particular release. And there'll maybe be a set of releases over time, which is like the product roadmap, version 1, version 2, version 3, version 4 kind of thing. That's the middle ground. Sometimes there isn't a requirements process. And I think that's a bad thing, because bad things happen when there's no requirements process. Now, some people think that's the new way of doing things. We should say, let's just get on with it and do agile-based iterative prototyping and continuous beta and all these other kind of buzzwords you hear. I find that kind of scary, because if there are no requirements, it's hard to know. You tend to focus on the ones which are easily measurable in that kind of process. So you can measure functional properties that way, but it's hard to get some of the higher level quality properties designed that way. And it's hard often to modify things that are built in that incremental way, because there isn't the sense of there was a platform that gets most of the requirements, and then we build these kind of customizations or extensions or modules which add on functionality. Again, this is an ideological point of view that I'm not ashamed of having. I can see by Lewis's body language he exacts exactly the opposite point of view. No?
No,
but I don't want to have my air traffic control systems built with agile methods. I kind of want to have requirements that's going to have performance and reliability and things like that in them. And it's hard to do that when you haven't got a formal specification of what you're trying to build. So I'm not saying that kind of prototyping and agile methods are bad, but systematic agile methods are better. And we can talk about that later on this semester, about model-based prototyping and about more systematic techniques for exploring the design space, which is what I think prototyping really should be about. But how many have heard your companies or yourself say, we want to be first to market, so we'll just ship something really quickly and let the market help us fix it? Yeah, right? Okay. But we're just building a prototype. We'll throw the prototype away anyway and then redesign it. And you never really redesign it, do you? Because it's now in the market. You've got customer support issues with that one. So it's very tempting to do that, but I tend to have a slippery slope toward absolute anarchy in design implementation. Yes?
If you're deploying to the web, you can be a lot more flexible than
Yeah.
So you can't iterate on your air traffic control system once it's built, because people are inside.
That's right.
If the next time your customer comes to your website, it's different and has a new feature, great.
I agree. There are situations where you can iterate in place. But we haven't got completely consistent design methods for that situation. So I've often had conversations with people who are, say, the traditional usability people, who find it hard to do what they want to do in terms of, like, let's do user testing and stuff when we're shipping a new product every day. So we haven't quite come up with completely consistent methods for some of these more agile, incremental release methods. But I'm caricaturing this for a point, which is why I want to motivate that what we really want is to have somehow techniques for developing requirements which are as agile as developing the things. And that's been one of the big barriers, because as you've seen, even with your very quick, rapid techniques of getting ideas, it's taken you a month to get some sense of where you're going in your projects. And, you know, if you were coding every day something, you know, there'd be a kind of a mismatch of time constants there between the way in which you develop requirements, understand the real design context, and the ability to actually make changes in the code. And so, some people say, well, there's no hope. That means there's never going to be a way to have requirements that sync these new methods. Other people are saying that if we had better technology for requirements, we'd be able to do more of that agile requirements. And in fact, I'm going to show you next time, and we're going to try to use in our projects, a new kind of technology for requirements, which looks really promising, because it really is an agile requirements process where you literally, on a good day, can type in a paragraph, like a requirements paragraph, a narrative scenario of some kind, and then push a button and it'll try to generate use cases and diagrams and figure out where the logical problems and your requirements are to help you consistently create reliable, consistent, complete specifications. So we're going to try this out. We tried it last year. It worked pretty well, and presumably it's better a year later. And we're going to, at least one person on every team will use this. The person who's got the most interest toward this problem. And we'll introduce that to you next time. Requirements should be can be qualitative or quantitative, but they should always be verifiable. It's really easy to have a requirement which is kind of a motherhood requirement that is just hard to tell whether you satisfied it or not. I'd like to be able to say things like, I can learn to send a message with my new communication system in 5 minutes, rather than, it should be easy to learn. Because easy to learn is, doesn't have a something you can measure and say, yes, we met that requirement, or no, we didn't. It's less error-prone. Well, compared to what? Right? You want to say, you make, basically, a new user is likely to make fewer than one error every hour operating this machine or something like that. You saw a little bit last time, and you'll see as you try to do some of these information flow kind of diagrams that it can be very helpful to draw these process or document flow diagrams, because that'll help crystallize places where you have missing information flow, the things where they're dropping through the cracks in your design pattern, whatever it is. I guess I'm sort of surprised that more of you haven't done more of this. I get the sense that this is new to you, writing formal requirements. How many of you people have done a significant amount of this? I know that Andy has. Amy probably has. Okay, not all of you. Okay, so is it because you worked in more researchy kind of things or more small company kind of things? You're just kind of closet hacker anarchists. That's it. Now, I've worked a lot in big companies where, like, say, Bell Laboratories, we were building things like switches to run the phone system. And I kind of grew up in an engineering culture where there was a lot of rigor and requirements process. Even in the research end where I was more in, we still had to be compatible with a culture which was, we're building this to last 100 years. It better work kind of thing. So maybe I'm too old school here and I have to take some agile medicine or something. I will let some of you educate me. So if any of you can find something which will make me... Yes? Okay, I mean, again, I'm making a caricature. It's not all or none, but I want to make a point that there are these different views of how to do this and that often people are ideologically aligned with one or the other. Let me give you switch gears and have a more concrete kind of bit of advice for a few minutes about how to write clear requirements. There's a movement that has actually got a fair amount of traction in technical documentation circles for writing requirements called Simplified Technical English. And the idea is that if we can write things in a simplified grammar and logic and vocabulary, we can make things more precise more rapidly and detect logical problems in our specifications. It's actually a good idea because I'll show you some examples of what you might naturally write if you said, well, how does this procedure work? How should this procedure work? People might naturally tell you things in ways that are not going to be unambiguous or even logically consistent. So here's some examples. Look at the first one. It says, before, this is a way to switch, to replace some blade in some machine. Okay, so imagine something which cuts or something. Could be a very dangerous machine. And it says, gain access to the blade. After removing the blade, the new blade may be put in by proceeding in the reverse order that you did to get it out, using gloves to avoid injuries with the teeth of the blade. Before you do any of this, you should turn off the power. Now, again, that sounds kind of corny because it's like pathologically a bad instruction, right? But you think about it. Suppose you were just following this along the book and it says, okay, take the blade out. Oh, shit. This thing's still on. You got your hands wrapped around it. It could be really bad. Okay? So the techniques of simple English say use short sentences, use active voices, make sure that all the actors are explicit, make sure all the transitions are explicit, and so on. So you say, make sure the power's off. Okay? Remove the blade cover. It probably should say, put your gloves on now, because you could cut yourself badly. Okay? Remove the used blade. Install the new blade. Put the cover back on. Again, it sounds silly to make this sort of contrast this way, but in fact, it's a lot easier to do the second one than the first one. And it's a lot easier to build things when the requirements are written in the second style than in the first style. So let me just give you another example, showing you some, I guess I have some common mistakes that you might find in narrative requirements. You have missing actors. So you'll say, if the order is incomplete, then... But it doesn't say who determines or what determines that the order is incomplete. You say, it's called the null transfer object. That is, you say, there's something being done. Some message is being communicated. Some transfer of control is taking place, but it's not clear how it's done. So you say, the clerk informs the manager. Well, by sending a message, by calling, by flipping the light on that flashes red. I mean, how is that information being sent? Okay? If X, then Y. Well, what happens if not X? Okay? That's like the otherwise orphan. You'll say, if this, then this, then this, this. Otherwise, well, what does otherwise connect to? Which of those clauses was otherwise really the sort of other half of? You might be missing some of those clauses. Okay? And often people, because they want to have not a boring style, will say, the project lead, the project manager, lead engineer, they'll use multiple words for the same thing, and you don't know if it's the same person or not. It's a vocabulary problem. Is this the same person or a different person? You want to be less boring, so you use different words to refer to the same person. But that makes it hard to be sure you have the right actor in mind. So, what's interesting about this is that this is what the software from Raven alleges that it can detect. So you type a paragraph and it says, warning signs, here's these problems. And actually pretty interesting. So let's look at these. And this I want you guys to look at for a while. Maybe, I guess you can do it by yourselves. Or maybe, turn to the person next to you and spend a couple minutes finding some of the problems in this, just to see if that made sense to you. So take a look. Alright, what do you see? Okay? Hopefully that I just told you about in these in this set of instructions.
We're doing a class exercise right now. Hold on.
I mean, this is how people write left to their own devices. Okay?
So, what do you see that's problematic in these instructions? Marianne?
So, first of all, number 4 should be somewhere between 2 or 3 so people understand that the consequences of rejection.
Right. Otherwise, binds to something. Not exactly what it binds to. Okay? What else? Michael?
POR, PO,
purchase order
request.
Yeah, is POR a purchase order request? Maybe it is. Not clear. Could be. Anything else?
What happens if it is not less than $5,000 and the PR is not?
Yeah, we're missing some logic. We're missing some logic.
They have not mentioned what the valid budget number. So they've just put, if it has a valid budget number, then...
Yeah, well, so there's a missing thing to do.
What's a valid number?
Yeah, how do you decide what a valid number is? Who determines it? Does the clerk decide? Maybe somebody else decides. It isn't clear. Stephanie?
How was the purchase order request submitted?
Right.
A document or phone?
Right. How was notification done? Right. Lots of problems with this. And so Raven will go, I don't know what notify means. What is the message that's sent to cause this notification? We'll say, is POR the same as PO? And so it's a very nice thing. It sits there and it's like your nagging English teacher to help you write better, simplified English. Hey.
I just want to counter example to this. The point you're making is that sometimes if you're too explicit in your requirements, it doesn't allow the person developing to be creative enough to come up with better solutions to what you require.
Absolutely. And we'll talk about essential use cases and essential requirements that are written in a way which is completely technology independent to make sure that's possible. But there's a difference between being technology dependent and being ambiguous or incomplete. We're focusing on incompletion and ambiguity here right now. Okay. And again, part of that is that you don't want to do this too early. Because don't work hard on getting everything right if they're the wrong requirements. So at some point you have to sort of sell your requirements back to the people who gave them to you. I mean, that's sell isn't right exactly where, but I use it in quotes because it's like you've got to somehow communicate your understanding to the stakeholders who you're trying to satisfy and say, do I have this right? Did I capture your requirements in a way that we can be precise about them, and then we can, you know, worry exactly about some of this stuff. So don't worry about some of the fine details until you have the big picture right. And that may be require some iteration with your stakeholders. And we'll talk about prioritization in next lecture using something which has come to be called Moscow prioritization. Anyone heard of Moscow prioritization? Stephanie has, because she did it this summer. Moscow prioritization has nothing to do with the Russians. It has to do with the fact that you have a lot of things you might want to do and you have to say which ones are the most important. So as a bit of a preview, this is the order in which you want to prioritize things. Some things, you want to guess? Must be done to be a satisfactory solution. Some things should be done. Some things could be done. Some things won't be done. And it's important to have the won't be done category as well as the other ones, because that says we're not going to go there. Even though we identify them as requirements, they're out of scope for this release, phase, version, whatever. Okay. We spent a few minutes talking about the kind of things I talked about on Monday when I talked about document anthropology and archaeology. In information-intensive context, there's often a set of generic requirements that you can almost always look for and essentially figure out how important they are, because they're basically based on information and process models and flows that are in those definitions, in those environments by definition. These are I think there's about 8 or 9 of them that I have gone into companies for years as a consultant and try to get a sense of how important are these relative requirements relative to each other. So, for example, you say, I want to be able to capture information in an automated way. I don't want to have any manual data into anything. I want to be able to have things happen automatically. It could be voice input, it could be touch screen, it could be something, but no manual entry of anything. That could be a requirement.
I want to be able to have, once it's entered, to be untouched by human hands. Straight through processing to the end. I want things to be timely. I want the information to be available when I need it. Okay? I want it to be accurate. I want it to be complete. I want it to be validatable. I want it to be interoperable. I want it to be standards compliant. I want it to be customizable. I want it to be usable. I want it to be identifiable as something coming from this particular source. Now, you can easily tell that those cannot all be satisfied at the same time. Because the effort required to make a document or information source complete means wait till we have everything before we publish it or send it to the other party who is expecting it. Effort to make everything accurate means let's do extra testing of that information to make sure we can stand behind it or guarantee some degree of tolerance or specification. So on and so on. And I, for years, would go into companies and essentially do surveys and interviews and say, here are some things that I think you want to, that you could possibly be concerned about. What are your priorities? And I'd ask the management. I'd ask the engineers. I'd ask the customers. I'd ask the customers, what are your priorities? What do you think their priorities are? And they'd be different. And you then have these meetings where you say, there's some real issues here because you have different priorities, inconsistent priorities, completely incompatible, infeasible priorities. What are we going to do about it? And my favorite story, which I do have time to say, from a company I won't name, we were at a meeting where we were talking about priorities, about this kind of debriefing session, and there was a technical marketing person in the room and some engineers. And we have a discussion about different things are important to different kind of people. And an engineer gets up and runs across the room and puts his arms around this technical marketing person and starts screaming, "You moron!" And shaking this person by the neck. And said, "You just said you took my document and you wanted to look like a really sharp-looking piece of work from a kind of graphic design piece standpoint. And so what you did was you took the table of those numbers in the engineering data sheet and you made all the columns the same size. You did that by rounding off my last year's work. Okay? I spent a year making this number be a certain one with my test and you basically rounded it away. My customers care about what that number was. They'd rather have me send them an email with what that number was. They can decide if they want to build with that chip. Not wait for the pretty, graphically, elegant, balanced document. But this person said, it matters so immensely that we have professional-looking documents, doesn't it? Isn't that important to our company? This guy said, you are a moron. Our customers care about the numbers in these documents, not about the way they look. But this person was in tech, publishing, marketing, and they spent the whole career worried about looking documents. And this person almost killed them. Literally, arms on the neck, shaking their neck. Because it dawned on them that there was this big mismatch of priorities and they were undermining his work. It's an unforgettable story. So, you'll have this situation where people say, it's really important that things are prompt. And you say, well, does that mean it's okay to have them be approximate? What do you mean? They got to be accurate. Well, should we take the time to test things so they're accurate? No, they got to be quick. You can't get both. Okay? And it's sort of obvious when you think about it sitting in this room, but when you're in the middle of the conference room, people yelling at each other, going, this is essential. You say, well, our customers think that we don't think it's essential because they want to get the documents emailed to them as soon as we have the wrong number. Okay? And this literally was, oh, this person was going to get strangled. That kind of, really, it's like almost a cartoon kind of behavior, shaking the neck. Right? That's scary. I thought, I caused this. Oh my God. I'm an accomplice. All right. I'm going to talk a little bit more. The last thing I'm going to talk about is business rules. Business rules is a kind of buzzword that's emerging now in information systems design as a way to specify requirements, essentially to distinguish, or to be very precise about specifying constraints on on typically on information values or information processes or various other kinds of things related to the to information models. There are a lot of ways to classify these. Some worry about data constraints versus behavior constraints, single item constraints versus multiple item constraints. I have a categorization scheme in my book that I, so I say yet another requirements taxonomy from my book, and I have rules, eight kinds of rules based on what they apply to, and they can apply to the abstract conceptual model, the physical model, that is the implementation, or to instances. So this is like, do they apply to all instances of a type, or only specific? You look at every individual item separately. Let me just give you some quick examples of this, and then we'll have time for our projects. So there are semantic rules where you are really basically specifying what things mean. So you'll say, when we say auto, it's a type of vehicle. It may be important if you're trying to figure out some way to kind of aggregate data across some set of products, let's say. Okay? The order number has to be unique. Okay? There could be structural rules that say what things go together. Every order must have an order number and a buyer and an issue date. Essentially, this assembly kind of rule. You could say usage rules. That is, if you have an employee salary, it can be changed by the manager, it can be viewed by the person, but it cannot be even seen by the student clerk. Right, so it's sort of a who has access to some piece of information. So access or usage rule. You could have syntactic rules that say this must follow some syntactic standard. It must be using UBL, it must be using X12 or something like that. We could have a processing rule that says if the balance is more than $1,000, freeze the account. Okay? Again, this taxonomy will sort of give you a sense of have you thought about all the different kinds of constraints that you might have to be modeling. It could be presentation rules. These are the least important ones because this is the one these people care about the most. Things like we should always have, you know, a blue binder on our documents so that people know what comes from Big Blue. Okay? Or the title should always be centered. We should always have a description that's in big type next to our picture. Things like that. And finally, we have content rules that are about the values of specific items in a document or the dependencies between them, like the start date has always got to be before the end date. Things like that. Okay? The balance should always be bigger than zero. Things like that. Now, these things, of course, could be in combinations. If the customer's account balance is more than $10,000, send them a past due notice by email, fax, and voicemail, whatever the rule might be. The point is, this is more likely what you're going to see, kind of a complex rule, but you can think of it in terms of the pieces that go into it. Why this matters is because what's really happening now more and more is people are using what are called business rules engines or decision engines in their implementations. It's sort of a service architecture view of the problem where they're saying, instead of having rules like this built into the code that runs the application, they're saying, let's have a little box that where all the rules live. So, for example, here's a picture from a book called Smart Enough Systems by James Taylor. Not that James Taylor. Writes about decision support systems. And here you see an example. Here you have a bunch of different interfaces or channels. We have the kiosk, the store, the direct mail, telemarketing, different ways of getting customers to interact with some system. They might interact with supply chain management, a billing system, a customer resource management, an ERP system, which these rules are going to be enforced. But instead of building all those rules into the software here, you have something like this, a rules engine where that's where the rule is enforced. So for example, if you put a credit card into a machine someplace, an ATM, or a terminal at a checkout counter or on a web, surely you don't want to have three pieces of software which decide whether that credit card is good or not. Has that customer exceeded their credit balance? There should be one piece of application code that does that credit test. It should be sitting in some decision engine someplace that all of them request as a service.
That way, it can be more readily changed. If the bank says, we got to tighten credit because we have too many bad loans, let's change the rules for that credit check. They change it here and not here. Furthermore, the coder, the programmers who wrote the software that runs the application that says, run credit check here, don't have to know what the rules are, don't have to bother fixing them. They run the test that says, run credit check, and it asks the service, the credit check service, to validate that credit. So we basically componentized the enforcement of that business rule by pulling it into a decision service business rules engine of some kind. If you look up the words decision service or business rules engine, you'll find lots of companies now publishing, now selling that kind of thing to plug into your application environments, because it's a whole lot smarter than having that stuff be written in the code of your application. And that's it. So, for Monday, we're going to talk about use cases, which is a particular way of depicting and capturing requirement specifications. And we'll talk about Mosco, and then we'll talk about Ravenflow, the new technology that we're going to use in our assignment in a couple of weeks, when we try to take our requirements and systematize and prioritize them. And with that, project time.